This is Ann Cox, and welcome to Moving Mindfully. Here we delve into the psychology behind physical activity, and we talk about the many different paths to getting the most satisfaction and enjoyment out of moving our bodies. I also try to connect the research or the science behind physical activity to the actual practice itself. Let's begin today's episode.
Looks so easy for the boys to make noise, to make noise, while the girls sit screaming in their seats, silently scared to eat. Why should she feel afraid to take up space? To take up space. And why have we created a place where the girls?
Hi, everyone. Today we have a very special guest that I'm talking with, and it's Ivy Ricci. And I want to tell you a little bit about how I met Ivy and the things that she has done. I met Ivy when she was, I think, first a guest teacher at Nourish, the yoga studio that I've been going to in Moscow, which just became under new ownership, and it's now called Kula, if you're interested in checking that out in Moscow, Idaho. What I knew of Ivy at that point was that she had done some really interesting work on how to support positive body image through yoga. So I just had to take her class. I had to meet this person and learn more about her method and what she does through yoga. I was immediately drawn to her because when I very first met her, she just exudes this really authentic energy and authentic beauty in the truest sense of that word beauty. I think part of that comes through her unconditional acceptance that she communicates as a yoga teacher and just as a person more generally. So in terms of Ivy's background, she has been trained in integral, Iyengar, and Anusara yoga. She has studied with Tao Porshan Lynch, Isha Myers, Christina Sell, and Darren Rhodes. And she has also studied and practiced in Northern India. So she has a wealth of yoga experience and different kinds of yoga training in her history. So we're just going to start here in a moment, but although we may not be talking about it directly today, I also want to note before we begin talking about body image and yoga that Ivy is also a musician. She writes songs, she sings songs, she plays a lot of different musical instruments, and she just released her latest CD called It's Hard to Know, and I highly, highly recommend this CD. It just touches my heart. And at the intro to this particular episode, we played Girls Sit Screaming, which just, I listen to it on repeat all the time, Ivy. I'm sorry, I hope that doesn't embarrass you.
That's wonderful.
This song just, it just touches my heart, and it touches some of the things that we will talk about today regarding girls and women and their bodies and taking up space and all of those good things. So to start, I just want to hear everything you have to say today, Ivy. Can you tell us a bit about what you do or what you might call your dharma or your path that you walk in this life?
Well, thanks, Anne. Thanks for that beautiful introduction. My dharma, what an amazing question. I have found that my dharma is like an octopus, if not one with extra arms. I actually just made friends with an octopus here in Port Angeles, where I've been living. Her name was Oceana, and she captured my heart so much at the Marine Life Center here that I started volunteering, and actually had the opportunity to link arms with her. And you know, the octopus is an interesting creature in terms of its eight limbs, which is related to yoga. But we'll get back to that part. Anyhow, so let's see, what's my dharma here other than holding hands with an octopus? I am here, I've learned over the last couple of decades to write. I'm here to record music and perform and teach music, mostly as a way of staying engaged in a creativity cloud that can hopefully move along and kind of rain and snow on other people, like it's snowing today here. My goal is to stay engaged in my own creative flow so that my students, whether they're music students, yoga students, or just people that I encounter, that creative energy will be contagious. I believe we all have a really powerful creative energy within us, and that is one of the things that I think is blocked when we lose access to the strength and the power and the self-esteem and the correctness of our own bodies. So that's the one of the music and creativity element. I also know that I'm here to be a part of changing standards of beauty for women in this country to be inclusive, so that again, that creative energy that gets locked up in trying to change our appearance can be funneled into something that is more contributive to ourselves and to society. And I'm definitely here on a mission of social justice and equality and unity and love. And for the most part, I'm not terribly concerned with how I end up being able to be engaged in those activities, but more just that whatever I do, I'm engaging in those activities. And it ends up looking like practicing and instructing yoga, practicing and instructing music. My husband and I make handmade paper up here, which is a really fun way to have a tactile encounter with creativity rather than the music that we're always wrapped up in our minds. Anyway, long answer to the question about Dharma. Mostly, I'm here to learn how to love, and I'm here to learn how to be of service and to pay attention.
No, that's lovely. And you can talk as long as you want to answer any of these questions. I'm interested in all of it. I could talk to you about your creative pursuits, about your music, about your paper making. Like any of that would be so interesting to me. But today we'll focus a little bit, although feel free to weave in those other aspects in terms of body image and yoga and movement, maybe more generally. Because that's one of the things that we talk about on this podcast quite frequently, and because the research shows, and I believe strongly that it has a big impact, not just on our physical and mental well-being, but also specifically on our physical activity behavior, and experience of physical activity. Before I get to the next question I have for you, I want to share with you that taking your four-part body image series, Bodhisattva series, was the first thing that made me explicitly write down my dharma or my path. I think you challenged us to do that. And it has stayed with me so strongly and almost verbatim. Like almost the words haven't changed, which is, it just really stuck with me. And so much so that this semester is the first time I was, since then, that I'm teaching my larger undergraduate general sport and exercise psychology classes again. And I opened up with that yesterday. And I didn't use the word dharma because I don't want to scare people, and I
That's a
wanted,
smart.
but I said, I'm here because, I don't know if I said it was my passion or my path or why I'm here, my purpose. But I said, I'm here, and I wake up every day excited to come teach you all and do this work because I'm here to help people feel good moving in their bodies. And I think that's what I wrote down when you asked us to. And I've added the part and help them sustain a physically active lifestyle across the lifespan. I think I would add that part. But yeah, just to help people feel good moving in their bodies, and so many people simply don't. What can you tell us about your own history related to body image, which I'm guessing might inform the work that you do today?
Oh, absolutely. That's so cool to hear that that question about your dharma stuck with you. Thanks for sharing that. My own history related to body and body image can best be described by the word grisly. Grisly. Yeah, I had tremendous challenges with body image as I was growing up, and like most of us in this culture, I'm trying to, you probably know what the actual statistic is on eating disorders right now. But it's a lot. It's somewhere in like roughly 80% of all women are in this country are affected in one way or another by body image or eating disorders. Anyhow, so I don't feel alone when I say now that I really hated my body as a young woman, and I was given messages from all around that that was the correct way to feel, you know, from the culture of dieting that I witnessed in many of the women that were in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, you know, when I was a teenager. But I was pretty much, you know, I've succumbed, I fell for it. I came into that dark place that so many of us know of, basically just not appreciating my body for what it could do for me physically, but rather looking at it as a project and as something that needed to be radically transformed and changed in order to be even lovable. And so that is why I'm so passionate about this work, because I know that if I had known on a deep level the purpose of my body, which is, you know, to basically be my teacher that shows up in so many different ways to, you know, all the involuntary functions of my body, my breathing, my heartbeat. Those are teachers on how to show up, which is such an important aspect of being alive and being contributive on this earth. But also, you know, if I had been indoctrinated into a belief system of self-esteem and of female strength and you know, that every element of my body that in one way I critiqued because it didn't match up to the mainstream beauty standards, that instead I could see that as somehow, even if I didn't know it yet, a necessary function or structure that would help me with my dharma.
Right. So during this time, particularly growing up, what relationship did you have to physical activity?
Well, physical activity when I was pretty athletic as a kiddo. You know, I ran really fast. I had a good, you know, good streak of competitive nature in me. I think around fourth or fifth grade, I started to see exercise more as a way to control my weight and my body. So it went from, you know, maybe you know, just healthy running around, just kid stuff, to as at the first signs of womanhood, essentially being initiated into the idea that exercise was a way to lose weight. So I did. I exercised a lot, but the nature of it completely changed. It went from something that was fun and like a healthy challenge, something that was more, you know, done often at night or, you know, at times when I wouldn't be seen. Yeah, so it changed radically at that turning point from, you know, being a child to being a young woman.
Interesting. Yeah, that shift is one of the things I'm really interested in. I've been reading about theories of embodiment lately, and there's a developmental theory of embodiment, and one of the things that they talk about is how that shift happens for girls, but not so much for boys. And you know that for boys, it's still socially acceptable to play, essentially, and primarily to play sports, right? There are still limitations for men and boys as well as women and girls, different limitations, but they're still allowed to enjoy it, and that's promoted. And then what you just said is what I don't want to see happen to my daughter, right? And
Exactly. Yeah.
how do we help young girls navigate those changes and societal expectations during those changes so that that relationship with physical activity doesn't become what you just described? Like, talk about sucking the joy out of something that feels
Yeah.
amazing, and we as a society and just found the perfect way to just rip that out of the hands of young girls.
Yeah, and that's why I'm so passionate about working with that age group as well, because and that's some of the work that I just got enrolled in here in Port Angeles. But it is so important to vote, and that's also why it's important for us to do the work as adults. But because more than anything, they need examples. You know, if there hadn't been women around me that were having self-effacing thoughts about their own body and expressing them, you know, through dieting or just you know, the culture of what women talk about in locker rooms, which is so hilariously different from what I understand of what men talk about in locker rooms, although actually maybe a little similar when it comes down to it, just female objectification. But anyhow, I just think, I mean, it is because I had that experience that I can be of service to that demographic. You know, it's the whole idea of serving with our story, and it's the very thing that causes the most pain that if we're willing, we can turn around and be of service to others that are, you know, we can reach over the bridge, reach across the bridge, and see if we can help some people cross over.
That's right. That's exactly it. To jump ahead a little bit, what was your pathway into yoga? How did that happen?
Well, it's pretty well, if there is such a thing as arbitrary, it was something that I stumbled upon when I was 19. I was really not in a good place psychologically or emotionally. I was finishing up college in New York City. I was in the throes of a pretty intense drug addiction, and I was studying creative writing with a minor in education. And I signed up for a yoga class that I had no idea would be the beginning of something that for the next, you know, 2 decades I would seek out. And at the time, it was just an adjunct class. You know, I would show up at 8:30 or 9 in the morning very reluctantly with like a humongous cup of coffee and some kind of fat-free muffin or something, and just, you know, take the shapes and learn about a little bit of the philosophy. You know, in 1996, there
I was going to say it must have been
wasn't.
the 90s if it was a fat-free muffin because I was there
No,
too.
yeah, totally. It was the 90s to the max, and there was only it, there weren't, you know, 20 different kinds of yoga you could choose from. I don't think there was a yoga studio in the neighborhood where I was taking this class. Maybe there was an ashram somewhere, but anyway, the point is, it was hatha yoga. It was very basic, and yet, just from that semester of taking yoga when I was 20 years old, I knew from that point on that that was available to me, like that there was a refuge in yoga should I, you know, be in a new place that I had never been to before. Well, can I find a yoga class? You know, it was introduced, and I understood it on a profound level as a healing place, you know, a yoga class.
When you say a refuge and a healing place, primarily what things are you talking about? Being in what way being healed or a refuge from what? What kinds of things were you really gaining from it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So it was the first time that I had been instructed in a physical practice to encounter my body from within. And, you know, it seems really obvious and basic to me now, but focusing on things like my breath or like the quality of my thoughts or thinking about taking on a shape physically that I would need to think about where my toes were or my hip was, or, you know, just really thinking about my body from the perspective of taking my brain inside my body, basically, from the perspective of someone who had been seeing my body from the outside, you know, healing meaning to make whole. There was a connection between my external physique and my internal physical reality. And so that's what I mean when I talk about healing. And as far as refuge, you know, it's like a safe place. It was a clearly non-judgmental environment. Maybe yoga has gotten a little bit more judgmental or competitive in the last 5 or 10 years. At that time, it was really nobody was competing with anyone, and it was really just based on learning some of the philosophy and practices of this culture that were based on communing with something bigger than ourselves, communing with something that would be considered the divine.
Wow, there's so much I want to speak to in that. That's great. I had a very similar experience of this, because I do research on physical activity and body image. I was sort of having an experience of observing myself as well. I mean, I was very much experiencing myself, but I was also, as a researcher, very curious about that experience and trying to figure out why is this different and special and so profoundly different from other forms of physical activity. And it's that internal perspective is what I landed on. That even though I primarily had, until adulthood, we'll say, growing up, I had primarily used physical activity for competence to play sport. But even that, it's not an internal perspective on the body. We know. Like, we know that sport can protect girls to some extent from some body image issues to help them feel competent and useful and have function in their bodies. But there's a whole nother level to go to that internal perspective that you say it's like obvious now, but I'm so glad that you keep remembering to talk about it because it is not obvious, right, to the average person. And that struck me again because I forget too now. When we're doing this experimental study right now, testing the effects of mindfulness on treadmill walking. So just getting people on a treadmill to look at what happens when we have them listen to some audio that instructs them on how to be mindful of their body while they're walking. And we do little interviews afterwards. And it has struck me on multiple occasions, the participants are just saying, "Wow, what was that all about? I haven't felt my body before." Like, this is a novel, mind-blowing experience for them. Wow, we live in our heads. We live in our heads. So that was, yeah, that internal perspective was a big aha moment for me. What happened for you when you saw the intersection between yoga and body image? How did that come about for you?
Well, it wasn't until a lot of years later. So, okay, I started when I was 20, and I took, I practiced for the next decade somewhat irregularly, and I went to India and I practiced there as well, and learned a lot more about the culture and where yoga comes from. But it wasn't until I was 33, so it wasn't until 13 years after I started practicing yoga that I realized, when I came into another place of crisis with my body image, because I also, starting at the age of 16, had an eating disorder. I had bulimia and anorexia, actually. They go hand in hand really often. And I struggled with the bulimic aspect of it until I was in my early 30s. And at about 33, I came to a crisis with it because I had just fallen in love, and I had naively thought that, that if basically that if I felt good with my life, that I would be healed from my eating disorder. Well, in fact, the very opposite was true. I felt so overwhelmed by the feelings of being in love that it got worse. And so I realized that there was this connection between just big feelings and body image and eating disorder stuff for me. And I instinctively threw myself back into a very strong yoga practice, and simultaneously did the 12 steps of Overeaters Anonymous, and basically kind of put myself in a position in which I gave myself every potential way of becoming better from this illness, which was, really mostly psychological, I would say. The body image stuff, it's psychological and emotional and physical. I tried to address it from all of those different angles, And so around that time, I did start to feel better about my body. And it had gone in waves. A lot of times, so as a performer also, when I'm in the process of writing music, I'm not thinking about my body. When I'm in the process of laughing with friends, I'm not thinking about my body. I started paying attention to the different moments at which I was experiencing being in the moment, a feeling of flow and aliveness and connection to my environment. And yoga was one of those things. So the intersection of yoga and body image for me came with a greater kind of research, a very qualitative research that I was doing to try to figure out, yeah, how am I going to heal from this? And what are the moments in which I am connecting rather than kind of dissociating and seeing myself from the outside in? And yoga became a very clear time in which that was happening.
So, what do you think it is in your approach to, because you have used yoga in teaching yoga, you've used it as a tool to intentionally support maybe or perhaps build positive body image in others. When you're doing that, what is your intention? What are you doing intentionally that you think is perhaps taking it beyond just your average yoga class, which I think is probably going to do some good in and of itself. What kinds of things do you do intentionally through yoga to support positive body image?
Well, it depends. I mean, are you thinking more in the context of Bodhisattva, like the actual program that's designed for that, or just in like a regular class?
I guess it could be either. I'm trying to get at what you believe, what in research terms, I would call the mechanisms or the reasons why it works. So I'm quite trying to get at your understanding or belief system behind why yoga would support positive body image. And I guess I'm guessing that you would do things intentionally, perhaps starting with just an average class, that you would do things specifically in order to produce that outcome or to support positive body image outcomes.
Well, yeah, I can kind of break it down because the elements that I use in Bodhisattva, I do incorporate also into regular classes. And from my experience and from the feedback that I've received, the way it works is really fourfold. Basically, it starts so in a class, I will have students focus on the involuntary functions of their body. And simply by really coming to terms with how much our body is doing for us, without any effort on our part, two things happen. One, as I mentioned earlier, that's an amazing reflection of our bodies as teachers of how to show up. The heartbeat shows up without any prompting. You and I both showed up for this phone call. It's not showing up is a huge element of experiencing life in a way that is to the good of all. We can get back to that a little later. Anyway, so the showing up element of the breath and heartbeat. But more importantly, when we start to understand how much our bodies are doing for us all the time, an irrepressible feeling of gratitude emerges. And so that's one element. It's simply being grateful for our body for what it's doing for us rather than for what it looks like. So that's, one shift that I think is a really important part of the overall shift in the way we look at ourselves and the world around us. The next is I'll always is habits of mind. So I'll always encourage people to watch their thoughts. And often first I'll have them just watch their thoughts for self-knowledge, to know their own mind. Because it's by knowing our own mind that we then have an opportunity to creatively think a new thought or think in a way that propels us further towards our dharma rather than keeping us wrapped up in the pettiness, which often happens when the mind goes unchecked. So habits of mind is a really important element that I like to touch on. And then I'll often bring in creativity because I do think that at heart, at the essence, of ourselves. We are all extremely creative, and not only are we creative, but expressing our creativity is a necessary part of being healthy and being self-actualizing beings. You know, in the same way, this project you're doing of this podcast, this is a creative act, and I am sure that the exchanges that happen through the series will nourish your soul on so many levels, you know, and the people that you're talking with. So it's the creative acts like these, or like writing a letter or writing a song in a yoga class. It could be the creative element, could be including a small dance move in, you know, in the middle of a vinyasa. Like, that's something that I encourage. I encourage creativity. And then the fourth and final element that I think is really important is the element of seeing our place in a larger body in the community. So I think that I like to leave a space at the end of class often, or sometimes in the beginning, actually. It doesn't really matter where it comes, but an opportunity for people to feel witnessed, to be seen, and to be heard, actually, too. I think that a lot of what happens when we begin to communicate with each other about body image, or just about experiences that affect body image, is that we learn that we're not alone. And in so many teaching contexts, I've given some partner work and given people an opportunity to talk about their experiences, and consistently have gotten the feedback that people just didn't realize that somebody else had the exact same experience, or that thing that they felt so ashamed about was something that they were not alone in. And that's a huge element of healing.
So much good stuff there. I didn't know. I knew some of that, but I didn't hadn't ever heard you say it explicitly. And it's so cool. And you know, I have theories and hypotheses about what I think supports positive body image, and some of them are different, but there's just more. There's many ways and avenues, I think, to support it. One of the things I found really interesting, and I think a number of factors have played into it, but I've undoubtedly gone on a journey over the past 4 years in particular in becoming more embodied, becoming more connected to my body, mind-body connection, and just everything that that entails, just an awareness of what I'm feeling, a response to what I'm feeling, just being, right, in all of those feelings. Both psychologically and physically. And part of what has emerged from that for me is a desire to create. It's interesting because part of this also is rebelling against my childhood, because I decided when I was probably 7 or 8 that I was not a creative person. And I think I decided that, and who knows, but my interpretation is that I decided that because my brother had emerged as the creative person. And we can kind of like explain our whole childhoods that way, right? So he was the funny one and he was the creative one. And so that meant I couldn't be. When my daughter came along and we started drawing and coloring together, that's when it started to emerge for me. I was like, wait, this is fun. Why am I not creating? And why did I decide I wasn't creative? So I took a painting class, and yeah, I just kind of bit by bit started dabbling, and for no other reason. I believe there's no other reason to do it. I read a lot of Elizabeth Gilbert, and she'll support this view of creativity, which is that just do it because it fills you up. Just do it, and if it fills you up, it probably will mean something to somebody else. It may have an impact, but it may not, and that's okay. But it's like it's that essential part of life, of breathing. You're right, this podcast for me is outside of my formal job description, let's say, but it ties in with my work. And I just, even though it was going to add something else to my plate, I made a very firm decision that I had to do this. And that if I couldn't make time to do this, then almost the other stuff, I don't know, wasn't worth it or wouldn't happen, or something, that this just had to be a part of my life. I had to be doing something creative because of what it was giving me. So yeah, and I think that somehow the embodiment has contributed to that desire. I don't know if that makes sense to you.
Well, it does, because the way that we are trained and taught to think really is about how we can, be essentially, unless we are thinking critically about our culture in this world, we're trained to be cogs in a capitalist wheel. Like, we're not, it doesn't serve, the society at large, from a capitalist standpoint, for us to be creative and for us to, I mean, unless it's going to make someone a lot of money. Now, the creativity you're talking about is the kind that emerges from within. That's like joy that bubbles up and a desire to do something, just to take a leap. That's like, what would happen if I do this or try this? And, that's one of the reasons I'm so passionate also about staying involved in education, is that so many programs that would normally catalyze this way of thinking for kids are just being shut down because they're not considered important. And so, anyway, I guess the point is that we are indoctrinated. We're in our culture, we're not taught, for the most part, in the regular public education setting, that this part of ourselves is important. It's more, how to think in a way that will get you a job, how to think in a way that will get you a job, to support your family and to, make sure that there's a lot of, I don't know, there's a lot of fear, I think, instilled, that makes people afraid to dive into creativity, not just for fear of failing financially, but for fear of being judged or criticized or being weird or, but that's a kind of separate category, maybe, just, but when you talk about becoming embodied, in school, unless you're you and you studied, you've been studying this for a long time, and you have been like athletic and physical for so, your whole life. But I do think that's rare, and I think that as people have the experience of becoming embodied in a way that is, I don't know, like having, I'm thinking about the octopus again, because they have neurons like on all of their extremities. If we begin to cultivate neurons, maybe not literally, but if we start to try to see like from different parts of our body and, experience life in a way that maybe we haven't been taught to experience, but in a way that is delightful and contributive and, aimed towards creating more of the same. Like, how can we live in a way that will create more people to feel creative and embodied? But I'm straying from your question. I mean, you were talking about the connection between embodiment and creativity, and in terms of our energy systems within, that also does get addressed in some of the philosophical ideas that come through in yoga with regard to the chakra system. There's, when our hips become more open, it's considered that there's like a creative center there, in our second chakra, which is basically, it's where the pubic bone is, but in the center of our body. And there are all kinds of different creativity locks that can be unlocked in our body through the practice of yoga. So that, getting into a more energetic realm with it, there are those layers too.
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to hear from you, and everything you said was great. One of the comments you made is interesting about me being physically active my whole life, which I generally have been, except for 1 9-month period, which is another talk for another day. But I wasn't embodied.
Yeah,
So, you know,
right. That's the thing. Yeah, you
yeah,
can
I
be
wasn't
physical.
embodied. Yeah.
Yeah. What an
Yeah.
amazing awakening, though, to the, that was saved for you until this time of your life. It's like, what a gift.
Yeah, and I don't know, it kind of feels like it's true what they say that, you talk about people not doing some of these things that might be feel really authentic if you really tapped into it, but for fear, or fear of judgment. And there's something about turning 40, Ivy. There's something about turning 40 that I, you know, it that those things just don't matter as much,
Yeah, it was
and
liberating.
that doesn't shift for everyone, I'm sure, but yeah, it matters a whole lot less. You know, everybody on the hall knows that I'm the crazy yoga mindfulness person. But anyway,
That's great. Imagine how free you'll feel when you're 80.
oh, I
It's exciting.
it's exciting. It's exciting. So, you know, I want to do two things. I'd like to close with a question about maybe your bottom line or advice that you would have to offer in this realm of body image in particular. But I also want to make sure that you've said everything that's kind of risen for you in the conversation. Are there any nagging stories or pieces of the conversation we haven't touched enough on?
Well, I don't know if I've been as explicit as I'd like to be just about how important the work is to me. I mean, when I talk about it with you, it's like we kind of, you and I have talked about this quite a bit, and you've been in a bunch of my classes and workshops, and you really know where I come from. I guess the thing is that from a social justice perspective, when it gets couched in the field of yoga, a lot of times it can seem really woo-woo, and you start talking about energy and all that. And I'm comfortable in that realm, but not everyone is. I guess just to make it accessible, it really is a social justice issue for me. And it's not fluffy. It's not something that is, that is sort of important. It is, like, to me, the absolute, like, Bodhisattva and the work that I do with women and body image is my protest. The exploitation of women's bodies must be addressed, because turning a human being into a thing, or objectifying women, it's almost, or ourselves even, is almost always the first step towards justifying violence towards them. So it's really like it's not a woo-woo thing. It's very, like, concrete, like, in terms of the survival of, I think, humanity in a lot of ways. Like, the amount of energy that's wrapped up in women and girls acting in ways towards their bodies that is not self-loving, that is a crucial, like, area of energy, a bunch of energy that, as Naomi Wolf would say in the beauty myth, that if that energy was used towards anything creative or generative or life-affirming, that it would change the world. Like, it really is, there's so much power there. And I also think that it is essential in terms of healing the planet. The war against women's bodies on so many levels, not just body image, but it also is a reflection of the war on this planet, this divine feminine ball of wonder that sustains us and that is so endangered, and so many species are endangered. So I really, I guess the thing that's still kind of lurking for me is just how important this is. It's not just about body image. It's really about the survival of all living things, or, life as we know it, the way I see it. We can't afford to neglect this topic.
Thank you for that. I'm glad that you not only said it was a social justice issue, but explained exactly how it is a social justice issue, that it's not easy for people to think of body positivity as things like the Love Your Body campaign, right? Just love your body, love your body. But it is much more than that in terms of the effects of viewing and valuing women and girls as aesthetic objects. And so, in closing, what do you want to tell girls when they're, you know, when you work with them or to girls who are encountering that shift from physical activity and their bodies as places of joy to physical activity and their bodies as things that should be changed and shifted and malleable? Yeah, what do you have to say?
Well, I think the main thing that any of us have to offer to our young sisters and daughters is our presence. And so, I don't know that I would say any of these things directly. Maybe I would, but it's my my hope is that women will reach out to their younger sisters and daughters and show, maybe rather than tell them these following things, mostly that you are so much more than your external physical appearance, that the world needs you, and that each one of you has a unique set of attributes that will never exist in another human. I would hope that women and girls would learn themselves, learn who they are, learn what is important to their own hearts and souls, and to enjoy themselves and to share themselves and to be good to themselves and good to each other. And this most importantly, that we are all enough exactly as we are right now. And that can perhaps allow us to come from a place of self-love and self-esteem, where we're not seeking the kind of external validation that can lead to harmful self-behavior, self-harm. Make your art, be creative, don't care who says what about it. Find someone that believes in you and share everything with that person. And pay attention to your inner wisdom and let it be a source of wonder and truth and replenishment to all of those that you encounter, because we all have so much to offer.
That was perfect. Thank you so much, Ivy. I think that the listeners will have a lot to think about after this.
Well, thanks, Anne. Thank you so much for inviting me to share my thoughts and experience, and I hope it may be of service to someone.
Absolutely. Till we meet again, hopefully in person sometime soon.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of Moving Mindfully. I want to thank the College of Education at Washington State University for supporting this podcast. And I want to send a very special thank you to Maddie Roberts, my student who has been helping produce all of these initial episodes of the podcast. I could not have done this without her. Thanks to all of you for listening, and till we meet again.